Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned the following may contain names and voices of deceased persons.
And we need the truth. Honest was in our heart. The truth.
Like if whoever knows about it, any information, just come forward, see the police.
I heard a voice. I heard his voice saying, he's here, no? And they were there, just started hitting me and stuff. They was hitting me and dragging me and all sorts of things. And I was nearly about to get unconscious.
Did you guys have any luck finding Zaria?
No, not yet, no.
She's hard to find.
Yeah.
She's young.
Yeah, she's about 33.
Sort of yeah. She had a blue shirt on yesterday.
Okay. Do you want me to go straight or?
Julie Buck's only child, Zaria, is a hard woman to find. She moves around the Kimberley to stay with her large network of family and friends. I spent several days on the road trying to meet Zaria face to face, but had no luck. She doesn't have a phone, but we've talked a few times when she's had access to someone else's. More than anyone, she wants to know what happened to her mum back in the wet season of 1994. Zaria was one of the last people to see Julie Buck alive.
Yeah, that's what I want. That's probably an investigation.
Yeah.
That was Zaria in a brief conversation we had a few weeks back. She wants the West Australian coroner to hold a full inquest. At the moment, we still don't even have a cause of death for Julie. There's no explanation for how she ended up dead under a tree outside the Luma community in the Kimberley. Same goes for her boyfriend, Richard Milgan, who hasn't been seen since early 1994. How did it end up like this? The first time Zaria and I spoke came at an intensely personal time for her. It was January 29, 2018. The day before, she'd commemorated the 24th anniversary of the last time she ever saw her mum alive. Zaria was around 8 years old then. The final words Zaria's mum said to her were seared into the young girl's head. This is episode 6 of Wrong Skin. It's about justice.
November, see, it's the time of the year when the heat waves are starting to dance. Mercury rising, millibars falling, no time for a shaky romance. Sweat on the foreheads of babies adrift in dreamland. While into the pind and those old men are dancing a rain dance.
You know, we know where Richard is. Everybody knows where Richard is. You know.
Julie's big brother, Graham Bodie, has picked up on a feeling that's been building ever since this podcast started. More than a hope, there's a belief that soon the secret of where Richard's body is will come to the surface. People are nominating specific parts of the bush near Luma as places to start searching once more. Richard's younger brother, Wayne Milgan, was on those initial unsuccessful searches after the couple suddenly took off with a cigarette lighter, a swag, and Richard's dad's hat.
I thought they was, going to come back, but nothing. Till after, I didn't think much till later on, then realised that it was too long, you know, and then went for a search. Went for a ride and cut an hour off, couldn't find anything there.
I'm standing with Wayne over the bonnet of a car in a quiet spot in Luma in the late afternoon sun. The pain of not knowing what happened to his brother, his drum-playing bandmate, is acute.
And like for me, yeah, it's really, like, sometimes I get emotional and especially I worry for mum, you know, mum Annie, like that's her son, and I try keep her thing, you know, like being happy and thing, you know.
Wayne's talking about his deep concern for Richard's mum, Annie Milgan. She's not Wayne's birth mum, but he cares for her like she is. I've tried to speak with Annie in recent weeks, but haven't been able to. But I hope she gets the chance to speak out and get things off her chest. Only if she wants to, of course. Remember, Annie is married to one of the most powerful men in the Kimberley, former Land Council Chief John Watson. Police have been told that John Watson might be one of the few left alive who can help solve the mystery of Richard and Julie. And this is because of his status in the community and ties to senior local men who were apparently upset by the couple's wrong skin relationship. Nearly all these men have passed away. I'd mentioned in the last episode how this podcast is stirring up things long buried in the Kimberley. Well, just before this episode was due to be released, I heard that Darren Skinner wanted to talk. Darren was the bloke dragged out of bed and smashed over the head with an iron picket.
Yeah, they flogged him, yeah. Because they hit him everywhere with stick from head to foot.
By Kimberley Land Council Chairman Anthony Watson and his sister, Jonine. Darren's version of events puts Anthony's father, John Watson, at the centre of things as well. Darren says it all started with an argument between him and Jonine over a personal matter.
What happened?
We got a weekend off and I went to town and I was drinking in my other cousin's place. And the sister, Jonine Watson, came over to me. You know, we got some bit of argument there for personal business, you know.
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, well, you wait, I'm going to get my brother on you. And then I didn't sort of really worry about it. I went to sleep at my cousin's place, Lisa. This was early in the morning. And I was still asleep, too. I heard his voice saying, he's here, no? And they kind of just started hitting me and stuff. I tried to get up, but they just keep hitting me with sticks and all sorts of things. And
by the time they got Darren outside the house, he was fearing the worst.
There was, the house fence. They was dragging me next to that thing. No, they was hitting me all over the place, right there next to the fence. They was hitting me and dragging me and all sorts of things. And I was nearly about to get unconscious. I was just ready to fall out of conscious. And then they started carrying me, trying to carry me around at the back there. I think they wouldn't carry me like that for nothing. They wanted to finish me off over there where them trees were. That's my sister. He's lucky he came out and seen what's happening. Lisa, yeah, she sang out and what's happening? What? Then they dropped me on the ground and they ran back to the car when they seen Lisa.
The Watson trio were all charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm and aggravated burglary. But John Watson's charges were discontinued. His son and daughter pleaded guilty and were convicted but got no jail time.
When we went to court, they told us, oh, you don't have to be in the court. That's what they told us. That's why we didn't really know what happened to them, what happened in the court.
Darren's also among those with a hunger for justice when it comes to Richard and Julie. He was mates with Richard growing up.
We've all been a good friend to Richard, and you know, we sort of all grew up together. It'll be good. We need to find justice.
Julie's big brother, Graham, believes that finding Richard's remains will bring the Buck and Milgan families together once again to grieve with his mum, Annie Milgan.
I feel for that family as well as mine. You know, it's so I can get a closure on it and go and meet her when they come back together.
So much of Aboriginal history and culture is preserved in songs and stories. It's the same with the tale of Richard and Julie. Knowledge about what happened and why has been passed to members of the community who need to know. It's almost become like a Romeo and Juliet folktale in Luma. I've spoken to young adults there who said when they were kids, they'd ask their parents to tell them the story again and again. But there's one person whose account we've yet to hear, and she's more than just a storyteller. Julie's daughter, Zaria.
And gives him the right to do all that stuff.
No, no right. No, no human being has the right to do that to another one.
Yeah, especially to women. It's terrible.
I had a short talk with Zaria a few weeks ago, just as our first podcast episode was coming out. We talked about the violence that has gripped her part of the world and how women more often than not have copped it. I had a much longer conversation with Zaria in late January 2018. As I already mentioned, it was a time of year that brings back the worst memories. The call from Zaria came out of nowhere, and all I had to record what she was saying was my notebook. Zaria was in Luma in January 1994. She was a kid, playing with a cousin and a friend. All of a sudden, there was a disturbance nearby. A big Toyota four-wheel drive, packed with men with familiar faces. They were getting stuck into Richard. Zaria recalls her mum grabbing her and taking her to a little hill. From there, they watched Richard get a flogging. Then some of the men came looking for her mum. Zaria says her mum said to her, "Don't you forget who these men are and what they've done to us," before she took off. What happened next with Richard and Julie is unclear. Maybe the attack on them was designed to force them out of Luma, a banishment, if you like. It appears they made it to Derby, about 100 kilometres away. Zaria remembers getting a phone call in Luma from her mum, who was at the payphone in Derby, outside what is still known today as Rusty's IGA supermarket. Julie told her little girl she'd be back to pick her up, but she never did. That was the last time Zaria spoke to her mum.
It'll be good for us and names been given.
Wayne Milgan's talking about the need for culprits to be named.
That'll be good as well, even from mum's side, us, Morgan. We want to know, we still need to know, who was involved.
I'm certain Zaria has told the Cold Case Homicide Squad what she remembers of the last time she saw her mum and the faces she saw. I know Zaria's young age has to be taken into account when weighing up her story, and it was a long time ago, but personally, I don't think any 7 or 8-year-old would forget such a terrifying event or the last words their mum ever said to them.
Even the family, their family, Julie's family, need to know as well, from the coroner's report or what really happened, really.
In an ideal world, and if the evidence is there, the families of Richard and Julie want charges laid against those involved. But the evidentiary burden required to sustain a murder charge beyond reasonable doubt is extremely high. I checked with WA Police just before this episode came out about the status of the cold case investigation into Richard and Julie. I was told it remained ongoing, and detectives were still urging people to come forward. Julie and Richard's families are looking to the West Australian coroner to give them the answers they've waited so long for by holding a full public inquest, which would require people to take the stand.
And for us, my family, need to find out whoever that person was involved. We want to know the truth as well, and where is my brother's, to bring him back home.
Wayne Milgan is one who believes there are people out there who truly know what happened.
The ones that now and still living now, they still got the key, like what can happen and where my brother is.
Joe Killer, the man who proudly showed me around the community his father founded in the 1970s, says Luma needs a dose of honesty.
And we need the truth.
Yeah.
And you will hear him today from my wife and my other two ladies and my daughter.
Yeah.
That's all the truth. Who was holding that thing inside of us? How did this thing, when we see it come out real truth and honest way, honest was in our heart. The truth.
Over the past year, as I've been digging into this story, my mind has often turned to wondering why it's taken so long for people to speak out. We've learned in this podcast that the Kimberley, for all its splendour, can be a seriously dangerous place. So I understand the fear of physical reprisal, but I have also learned that the fear of spiritual payback has also been a factor. Luma is strongly Christian these days, which I think is a big reason for the tensions with John Watson's passionately Aboriginal Jalmadanga community nearby. Neither trusts the other. It's pretty sad. Here's an actor reading from John Watson's 2012 book, Never Stand Still. In it, John makes the distinction between Gadya, or white man's Christian religion, and his own Aboriginal beliefs. And there's no doubt which side he's on.
Some of our people believe those church people when they tell them Aboriginal culture is wrong, and Aboriginal people the devil themselves.
And John Watson holds particular disdain for Aboriginal people who are Christian, as many in Luma are.
They're starting to cut out from their own culture, criticising their own mob, not seeing what Gadya culture is doing to us. They're believing white people. But I've always asked myself, why white people never believe Aboriginal culture? I haven't heard European people preaching Aboriginal beliefs, but I have heard Aboriginal people preaching the word of God. The Aboriginal belief is not in a book, and it's not the Aboriginal way to speak about our culture. This is our private business, and we can't tell everyone about our beliefs. When I go, I want people to say I spoke my language and practiced my culture. I don't want church people coming to my funeral and saying I was a church man. I want to be put away in my culture. People standing around and talking about how I was, that I was a strong law and culture man.
Still, there's some parts of white man law that John Watson's happy to be a part of, such as being a justice of the peace. And among some of the Christians, there's still a real fear of the power of Aboriginal magic. Julie's best friend, Lisa Skinner, explains it like this.
Those killing somebody and trying to make them, you know, walk around with no spirit in them. And then a couple of months later, if they get into a fight, they just drop dead like that, you know. And that's the Aboriginal way. It's make them like zombie, you know.
Yeah.
Mm.
How do you know if you've been sung?
Yeah, well, you got to just look at your skin colour. If you're turning black, well, that's it.
Okay.
That's Thomas Skinner, son of Nookanbar protest leader Dickie Cox, explaining how you can tell if you've been sung, which is the term to describe when a curse has been put on you by an elder with the right knowledge and skills. Many believe these magic men can travel vast distances in sleep, or turn into animals.
They just sing them and then wait for something to happen to them. And then there you are, that's because we sung you.
Pastoralist Froggy Finger has seen how traditional magic can play out for those who believe it.
I mean, they die from it sometimes if they really believe it, but not many do these days. That's how that show works, and then it's, I mean, it's fine, it works for them. You can shoot holes in it like any religion, eh?
West Australian Member of Parliament, Robin Chappell, has lived around outback Aboriginal communities for 40 years. He's been privy to a lot and seen the power of physical and spiritual punishments. Over an Indian meal in Perth in March 2018, I told him about my investigation into Richard and Julie and how tribal punishment for being wrong skin seemed the most viable explanation for their fate. Robin then told me a story of his own.
And the old fellow I was talking to was a lovely old man, always full of humorous anecdotes and all the rest of it. And we were talking about law and culture. And it was quite surprising. He was talking about people marrying the wrong way. And he referred to an incident way before Whitefellow was around, where his biological sister had run off with the wrong man. Now, his role in that community group was the policeman. And so the mob said, this has got to stop. So his job was, with some other men, was to go and find this couple. It was, the way he told it, it was so steeped in law and culture. So he talked about spending a long time, which would have been several months, tracking and following this couple down. And he said they'd run in willy-willies, which is a classic way of losing your footprints. And they said they were very clever. But eventually we found them. They were in a humpy and they were having sex. And his commentary was, we let them finish and then we killed them. It was so matter of fact, but there was even an element of compassion. They had broken the law, the culture. But this whole issue around having found them and found them in a compromising position and then carrying out the murder.
Of your sister?
Yeah. Real sister.
The sister killing story Robin was telling took place in the 1940s or 1950s and in an outback tribe which had little interaction with modern Australia. This can't be said for what happened to Richard and Julie. It was 1994, and people knew that killing was wrong and against the law. So after a year of investigating what happened to Richard and Julie and telling their tragic story, this is what I think happened. I reckon they were killed. There's not any other rational explanation for me. I think what started out as a punishment for being wrong skin got out of hand. But that can't be a justifiable excuse anymore. I also think that there may have been an element of jealousy driving things. Julie was promised to one of the old men, but made a conscious choice to be with a guy she loved and who was her own age. And I've been told this pissed off some of the older men who viewed promised young girls as an entitlement. Like Wayne Milgan and others, I reckon there are people out there that know the true story. As Wayne Watson told me, even though the Kimberley is a different place to where I come from, and what his friends Richard and Julie were doing was against the rules, they were hardly on their own when it came to jumping fences to have a wrong skin relationship. They were human, like the rest of us.
Well, Melbourne is different from that community to this community. Here, the culture, you can see how we all related, and you got rules to it, and things like what Richard and Julie did, that didn't happen then. Our old people did it before. They were jumping fences too as well. So, you know. But it's not only here, it's everywhere, in most communities. But getting killed by our own mob.
Nah, it's a beautiful spot, and you can feel the spirit in the air there, you know. It's always sacred for the people there.
Julie's brother, Graham, is describing her final resting place. His sister's grave is about a 1.5 kilometre drive along a dusty track at the back of the Nookanbar community. The entrance to the cemetery has two simple wooden crosses on top of piles of slate and stone. On my last trip to the Kimberley, I went there to pay my respects to Julie.
as I stand here, I can't help but think just how terrifying Julie's last hours or last days might have been. And what a waste. A young life snuffed out at 23 for no real good reason, and a daughter who never got to know her mum. She would have been a grandma by now. And according to those who knew her, a very loving one at that. But it's a peaceful spot here. And now my thoughts turn to Richard Milgan and his family. If only they could find a peaceful spot. And as his brother Wayne says, bring him home.
Yeah. Yep. Like it's been that long time, yeah. And just to help out, like really we wanted, like family wanted, just to bring him back home, you know, like if he'd been found, and just have a proper burial, yeah.
With Richard and Julie being the talk of the Kimberley again, Wayne Milgan hopes someone who has been holding on to this secret for so long will now speak up.
Like if whoever knows about it, any information or last seen or what had happened, just come forward, see the police, just to make us get on with our life like normal. Yeah. And for mum, you know, just to, like, in her pain, and she wants justice. Yeah.
Anticipation got it away, then goodbye to hard, hungry days. Pressure down in Kingstown, drift in a glass of bay. See the lightning bolt and the thunder roll. She's a-coming. While into the bend, and those children are dancing on rain dance.
For now, we've gone as far as we can with Richard and Julie's story. But this isn't goodbye. We'll be bringing you any further developments in the case. A story that had been lying dormant for 24 years is now out in the open and known across Australia. The courage of Richard and Julie's friends and family to speak out has lifted a shroud of secrecy that's hovered over the Kimberley since the wet season of 1994. The only way this mystery was ever going to have a chance of being solved was for people to talk. For the rest of us, we now know just a little bit more about what life is like in this bewildering and astounding part of Australia.
If you've enjoyed Wrong Skin, please rate and review on iTunes. And if you know more about this story, email Richard, rbaker@fairfaxmedia.com.au. Wrong Skin is investigated and presented by Richard Baker and produced by Rachel Dexter and Tim Young. The executive producer is Greg Muller, Tom McKendrick is head of video and audio, and Dr. Siobhan McHugh is consulting producer. And finally, the track featured in this episode, the one you're listening to now, is Rain Dancing by Kimberley band The Pigram Brothers from their 1997 album, Saltwater Country.
Just a bit of housekeeping here. In episode 5, I talked about the link between Nigina woman Anne Paulina and young Melbourne woman Phoebe Handsjuck, who was the subject of our 2016 podcast, Phoebe's Fall. I'd said that Phoebe had once gone out with Anne's son. I got my wires crossed. The relationship was actually between one of Phoebe's immediate family members and one of Anne's son's immediate family members. So I'm sorry about that. Regardless, Anne still says Phoebe was like family.